Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley and I bring you a story about Uyghurs living in China.
In a lively Muslim area of Nanchang, China, a huge factory produces computer screens, cameras, and fingerprint scanners. These products go to a supplier to major international technology companies like Apple and Lenovo. Throughout the neighborhood, women with head coverings walk through the streets. Signs with Arabic-based lettering advertise Muslim food stores and noodle restaurants. Yet the mostly Muslim ethnic Uyghurs who work at the factory are contained within a walled complex, surrounded by security cameras and guards. They rarely walk around town. When they do, someone walks with them and observes their behavior. The Uyghur factory workers are not permitted to practice Islam or cover their heads. At night, former and current workers in the area say the Uyghurs must attend special classes to study ethnic unity and Mandarin Chinese. The supplier Ofilm owns the Nanchang factory. The connection between it and tech companies is the latest evidence that companies outside China are using parts made from forced labor by Uyghurs and other minorities.
Uyghurs are a mostly Muslim Turkic ethnic group. About 12 million live in China's far western Xinjiang area. Over the past 4 years, the Chinese government has detained more than a million people in internment camps and prisons across Xinjiang. The Chinese government says it is fighting a rise in Islamic extremism as well as a separatist movement that calls for an independent Uyghur nation. It has described the internment camps as job training centers as well as boarding schools. But former camp detainees have said they were held in abusive conditions, forced to reject their religion, and made to promise their support to China's ruling Communist Party. When detainees are released from the camps, documents show, many are sent to work in factories. More than 10 Uyghurs and Kazakhs who spoke with the Associated Press said they knew people sent by the government to work in factories in China's east. Some were sent directly from the camps. Others were taken from their homes. Most were forced, they say.
A report released this month by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute estimates that between 2017 and 2019, more than 80,000 Uyghurs were taken from Xinjiang to factories in other parts of China. The report said it found conditions that strongly suggest forced labor, based on International Labor Organization definitions. At the Ofilm factory, Uyghurs are paid the same as other workers. But they are treated much differently, people who live near the factory say. The Uyghurs are not permitted to leave or pray, unlike the Hui Muslim migrants who also work at the factory. The Chinese government considers Hui weigh Muslims less of a threat than Uyghurs. They don't let them worship inside, said a Hui Muslim woman who worked in the factory for several weeks alongside the Uyghurs. They don't let them come out. If you're a Uyghur, you're only allowed outside twice a month, a small business owner who spoke with the workers confirmed. The government chose them to come to O-Film. They didn't choose it.
The Chinese government says the labor program is a way to train Uyghurs and other minorities and give them jobs. The Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs recently called concern over possible forced labor under the program groundless and slander, or false information meant to cause people to have bad opinions on the issue. But experts say that, like the internment camps, the labor program is part of a larger attack on Uyghur culture. They say the government is breaking up social and family links so that Uyghurs living far from home will become more like the majority Han Chinese culture. They think these people are poorly educated, backwards, can't speak Mandarin, said James Leibold, a professor of Chinese ethnic policy at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. So what do? You educate them. You find ways to transform them in your own image. Bringing them into the Han Chinese heartland is a way to turbocharge this transformation.
O-Film's website states that Xinjiang workers make screens, camera cover lenses, and fingerprint scanners. It says its buyers include Apple, Samsung, Lenovo, Dell, HP, LG, and Huawei. Apple's most recent list of suppliers, published in January 2019, includes three O-Film factories in Nanchang. It is not confirmed if the O-Film factory that AP visited in Nanchang supplies Apple, but it has the same address as one listed. Another O-Film factory sits less than a kilometer away. Apple did not answer repeated requests for information on which Nanchang factory it uses. O-Film's website also notes it supplies PAR Technology, an American sales systems provider. PAR Technology says it supplies products to major fast food restaurants such as McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Subway. The AP was unable to confirm that products from O-Film are being used by the fast food companies. McDonald's says it has asked PAR Technology to discontinue purchases from O-Film while it launches an immediate investigation. PAR Technology also said it would investigate immediately.
The internet has led to major changes in nearly every area of modern life, higher education included. Many colleges and universities have created internet-based study programs to meet the needs of today's students. But a growing number of experts say more change is required. A recent study from an American nonprofit research organization suggests colleges and universities must also expand what they are teaching. Researchers found a need for schools to add internet use training to their study programs. This training, they say, should center on how to best use the Internet to find trustworthy information. The Harvard Graduate School of Education and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation established Project Information Literacy. It examines how college students find, process, and use information. In January, the organization released findings from an opinion study of 37 professors and over 100 college students from across the United States. The study found the current generation of young people who grew up using the Internet on a usual basis is highly distrustful of much of the information they find online. They question how Internet companies use software programs known as algorithms to decide what information users see.
Discussion of the algorithms and how they affect online information is also lacking in college and university classrooms, the study found. Algorithms affect nearly every part of a person's experience on the Internet, notes Margie McMillan, a leading researcher with Project Information Literacy. She says it relates to how Internet companies like Google and Facebook make money. Search engines like Google are most people's entry to the Internet, says McMillan. If a person wants to find information about something, they usually start with Google's search bar. As soon as they start typing or choosing links, Google's algorithm starts gathering data about every choice users make. Google uses that data to try to find the websites or information that most directly relate to what the user is looking for, McMillan says. But companies also pay Google to post advertisements for products that could relate to users' search data. For example, if you search for places to take a vacation, you will likely start to see ads for travel companies, flights, or hotels. There are also possible harmful uses of the software programs. There are algorithms that are deciding who gets a loan and who doesn't, based on information about where that person lives, McMillan told VOA. There are algorithms being used to determine health care. There are algorithms being used in deciding who gets a job. We're seeing governments use it for decision-making in criminal justice. And part of the difficulty with algorithms is we don't always know which information they're drawing from.
The problem with algorithms like those of Google and Facebook is that they can limit the kinds of information people see, says McMillan. For example, if you look at news stories on a website run by people with a given set of political beliefs, the algorithm remembers those choices. The next time you search for news, your search engine will likely present more stories from websites that also express those beliefs. And political ads that represent those beliefs may start to appear in your social media feed. McMillan argues this can be harmful to people's critical thinking and lead them to believe that only one point of view is the correct one. Project Information Literacy found that college students understand that companies gather their data and direct their internet use. They are unhappy about this, the study showed. So, many students are sharing methods for avoiding algorithmic controls. This includes creating false online accounts so search results are unaffected by earlier searches. Also, a growing number of students are choosing to use a wide variety of websites so that they get information from different sources. Renee Hobbs argues that algorithms are not all bad. She is the director of the Media Education Lab at the University of Rhode Island. Hobbs says search engine algorithms can help you find what might be the most useful information faster.
But, she says, it is in the interest of internet companies to keep users on the internet for as long as possible so they see more ads. So search engine algorithms, for example, not only use your search history to decide what to show you, they also present links and information that are most likely to get your attention, and not necessarily those that are truthful or trustworthy. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Enberg. History is usually a process of slow change. However, certain events also can change the course of history. Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo was such an event. So was the first airplane flight by the Wright brothers, or the meeting between the Spanish explorer Cortez and the Aztec king Montezuma. All these events were moments that changed history. And so it was, too, with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war.
The surprise attack on America's large naval base in Hawaii was a great military success for Japan. However, the attack on Pearl Harbor had more than a military meaning. The attack would force Americans to enter World War II. More importantly, it would also make them better recognize their position as one of the most powerful nations in the world. In future weeks, we will discuss the military and political events of World War II. But today we look back at the years before the United States entered that war. The period between the end of World War I and the attack on Pearl Harbor lasted only 23 years, from 1918 to 1941. But those years were filled with important changes in American politics, culture, and traditions. We start our review of these years with politics. In 1920, Americans elected Republican Warren Harding to the presidency. The voters were tired of the progressive policies of Democratic President Woodrow Wilson. They were especially tired of Wilson's desire for the United States to play an active role in the new League of Nations. Harding was a conservative Republican, and so were the two presidents who followed him, Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. All three of these presidents generally followed conservative economic policies, and they did not take an active part in world affairs. Americans turned away from Republican rule in the election of 1932. they elected the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they continued to re-elect him. In this way, the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s changed to the more progressive policies of Roosevelt in the 1930s. The change happened mainly because of economic troubles.
So keep cool, and keep Coolidge is the slogan of today.
The 1920s were a time of growth and business strength. President Calvin Coolidge said during his term that the chief business of the American people is business. This generally was the same belief of the other Republican presidents during the period, Warren Harding and Herbert Hoover. There was a good reason for this. The economy expanded greatly during the 1920s. Many Americans made a great deal of money on the stock market, and wages for workers increased as well. However, economic growth ended suddenly with the stock market crash of October 1929. In that month, the stocks for many leading companies fell sharply, and they continued to fall in the months that followed. Many Americans lost great amounts of money, and the public at large lost faith in the economy. Soon, the economy was in ruins, and businesses were closing their doors. President Hoover tried to solve the crisis, but he was not willing to take the strong actions that were needed to end it. As time passed, many Americans began to blame Hoover for the terrible economic depression. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt was elected mainly because he promised to try new solutions to end the Great Depression.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
Soon after he was elected, Roosevelt launched a number of imaginative economic policies to solve the crisis.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers. And by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution, endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. Yes, the task can be helped by definite efforts to raise the values of agricultural products, and with this the power to purchase the output of our cities. It can be helped by preventing realistically the tragedy of the growing loss through foreclosure of our small homes and our farms. It can be helped by insistence that the federal, the state, and the local governments act forthwith on the demand that their cost be drastically reduced.
Roosevelt's policies helped to reduce the amount of human suffering. But the Great Depression finally ended only with America's entry into World War II. Roosevelt's victory in 1932 also helped change the balance of power in American politics. Roosevelt brought new kinds of Americans to positions of power: labor union leaders, Roman Catholics, Jews,
blacks, Americans from families that had come from places such as Italy, Ireland, and Russia. These Americans repaid Roosevelt by giving the Democratic Party their votes. The 1920s and 30s also brought basic changes in how Americans dealt with many of their social and economic problems. The 1920s generally were a period of economic growth with little government intervention in the day-to-day lives of the people. But the terrible conditions of the Great Depression during the 1930s forced Roosevelt and the federal government to experiment with new policies. The government began to take an active role in offering relief to the poor. It started programs to give food and money to poor people, and it created jobs for workers. The government grew in other ways. It created major programs for farmers. It set regulations for the stock market. It built dams, roads, and airports. American government looked much different at the end of this period between the World Wars than it did at the beginning. Government had become larger and more important. It dealt with many more issues in people's lives than it ever had before. Social protest increased during the 1920s and 30s. Some black Americans began to speak out more actively about unfair laws and customs. Blacks in great numbers moved from the southern part of the country to northern and central cities. The 1920s and 30s also were a time of change for women. Women began to wear less conservative kinds of clothes. Washing machines and other inventions allowed them to spend less time doing housework. Women could smoke or drink in public, at least in large cities, and many women held jobs. Of course, the women's movement was not new. Long years of work by such women's leaders as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had helped women win the constitutional right to vote in 1920. The 1920s and 30s also were important periods in the arts. George Gershwin wrote his Rhapsody in Blue, originally for piano and jazz band. It later went on to become a symphony concert favorite. Writers like Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill, and others made this what many called the golden age of American writing. Frank Lloyd Wright and other architects designed great buildings for American cities. Film actors like Clark Gable and radio entertainers like Jack Benny did more than make Americans laugh or cry. They also helped unite the country. Millions of Americans could watch or listen to the same show at the same time. Politics, the economy, social traditions, art. All these changed for Americans during the 1920s and 30s. And many of these changes also had effects in countries beyond America's borders. However, the change that had the most meaning for the rest of the world was the change produced by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. America's modern history as a great superpower begins with its reaction to that attack. It was a sudden event in the flow of history. It was a day on which a young land suddenly became fully grown.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.